Hello, and welcome to That's Theatre Darling, a podcast that shouts from the rooftops about the skill, creativity, and passion of all of the people who make theatre happen. My name is Amy, and I am thrilled to have you here. Let's get the show on the road, shall we? Today, I am very excited to introduce somebody whose work I have admired for a while now, a brilliantly talented playwright. I cannot wait to get into chatting to him. So without further ado, I am thrilled to welcome Tristan Bernays. Hello.
Hello. I'm also really glad that you were so nice, because I need a pick-me-up at the moment. I don't feel like...
Can you imagine if I started with something horrible, though?
This guy is a bit of a prick. I've read some reviews.
That would be quite a strange way to enter into a podcast, I think.
this fucker's come on to chat about himself, gas on like a nun. I'll tell you for why. It's because I don't know if there are any other writers and stuff out there who are struggling at the moment, but I am like really struggling for like inspiration at the moment. Like, it's a really difficult time to, because everyone's like, being a writer is easy, you just sit around at home, and you know, it's like, no, if I have to look at these same four fucking walls,
yeah,
I'm going to go bonkers.
Where do you get your inspiration from if you're looking at the same things all the time?
Well, this is the thing.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you here. You are actually my very first recommended guest, offered up to me by the gorgeous Holly Henshaw.
Holly Henshaw. She's
who you
so
worked with
fab.
On Teddy, didn't you?
She worked with us in Teddy. Yeah.
Yes.
And Teddy was all about costume. You know, yeah. Like, it's kind of the whole thing with, because you've seen Teddy, right?
So me and my partner still talk about it. It's so brilliant. Like, absolutely.
Aww, thanks, man.
I think, you know, one of the best things we've seen. It's just, yeah, great. I mean, and yeah, maybe you could tell us a bit about it, tell the listeners about it.
So, like, Teddy's a funny one. So basically, years ago, I used to be an actor, and I went to drama school, and I came out of drama school and went, that was horrible, I don't want to do that. And spent like a couple of years doing everything else that I could think of. So I worked as an admin assistant. I worked as I did a marketing internship with Sony Theatre. I ran a pub theatre for a summer, the Canal Cafe. You know, I did all these different jobs. I think I've done every job in theatre that you can think of. I even stage managed once, or I always forget the different levels of SM because I'm terrible at that thing. But the one where you're backstage, like handing people props and stuff.
Yeah, ASM.
ASM'd one show because the ASM was sick, or the DSM was sick and the ASM had to jump up, you know, so I got put to the bottom. And I think it's really important because it made me realize how hard it is. And I realized that doing every job in the theater means that you are a bit nicer to everyone and a bit more like respectful. You're not just like, I don't see why they can't do it. You're like, well, if you've done it, it's fucking hard.
Yeah.
It's difficult. And especially like having been an actor, actors are quite like, we can be childish, you know, because we're sort of coddled and the actors are coming in, bring the actors, whilst also being completely dismissed. It's a very weird position. But I'd done everything, and I was working as a development assistant at Soho Theatre, which I really enjoyed, but was like, this isn't for me. This isn't the world I want to do. I trained as a producer. That didn't really work for me either. And I was like, I've never written a play. So I think just before I quit my job to try and just be a playwright. I mean, I had to get a job as a box office assistant at the theatre as well. I went from the office to the box office. And I wrote this monologue for this course at the National Theatre called Teddy, about a teddy boy. Because I love rockabilly music and I love rock and roll and I love that period. And I particularly am fascinated by British identity at that period. Because America was very cool and sexy, and they had like James Dean and, you know, like... everyone's seen Grease. That's kind of our first entrance into 50s culture, is through this sort of like bubblegum poppy version of it from 20 years later. But Britain, it was shit. It was cold and grey and miserable, and there wasn't enough food, and rationing was still, it was awful. But there was this big influx of culture coming through, and the music was incredible. And the fact they were like, I'm going to wear my granddad's old Edwardian suits. And they just looked amazing. And I love wearing suits. And I was like, it's so cool. And I wrote this monologue to get on the course, and I got on and spent a week with some, Inuit Ellums was hosting it. He's amazing, amazing guy. And I left it in a drawer, this monologue, for like 4 years. And then I was like, I should do something with that one day. I should do something. And I wrote a bunch of other stuff and started making things. And then I took a show to Edinburgh and started to get my name known a bit like that. And then one day I tutor as well when I'm not writing. And this family paid for me to go to Sardinia with them to teach their two children, their son and their daughter. And it was a lovely job. It was not only was it a nice, fun teaching job, because I like tutoring and teaching very much, but it was also like a really cushy, you know, like they come along every now and then. I was like, oh, yes, I will hold on to you.
Yeah.
Nom, nom, nom. And so I was basically teaching the son 2 hours in the morning and the daughter 2 hours in the afternoon, and the rest of the time was mine. And if I'd have been there with someone, I probably would have gone to the beach and got drunk or whatever. But I was like, well, I'm not just going to do that for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I'll write. And I went into my drawer, you know, my files on my computer or whatever. And I was like, oh, Teddy, I should do something with that. And I literally wrote it in 2 weeks.
Wow.
The whole thing in 2 weeks. The first draft, this is. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think just because I'd been thinking about it fairly consistently for 4 years, like for 4 years, it was just trundling away in the back of my head, percolating and fermenting. So that when I came to write it, it just went blip on the page with so much ease that, I mean, obviously there was lots of work that went afterwards, but it just came out. And it did really well, and people, it got me an agent, you know, like it got me known a bit more. We came back a few years later and did a tour. Did you see it when it was at the Southwark Playhouse? When it
First time round,
With the lovely Joe Proin and Jen Kirby, and they were fantastic. And part of the thing was, like, I wanted it to be really fun. So I was like, I want it to be like what it's like being 17 and too stupid to know better.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of the idea behind it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just enormous fun, the whole thing. It was one of the most fun shows I've done.
Yeah, that definitely came across. It definitely, that definitely translated to the audience for sure. Like all of that, all of that fun and all of that energy was just brilliant. And so I would love to know what your first ever experience was of being in a theatre. What do you remember about it?
I genuinely think my first ever experience was going to see Button Moon at the Watersmeet Theatre in Ravensworth. I remember that being my first. I just had a lovely time. It's Button Moon! Hooray! Button Moon! But like proper like actual plays and stuff. When I was a kid, my mum and my dad sometimes as well would do Amdram at the church where my dad used to go. It still does, in fact. And I remember being in the Doll's House. You know, the little kids in the Doll's House? Doing them, and my mum played Nora, I think. And I remember being backstage and that being really fun and exciting. And those are two really early memories, I think, of like, but they're not really sort of indicative of when I kind of experienced theatres. I suppose, do you know what? That I remember felt like every week, but maybe it was every other week. So my mum and dad are big theatre goers, and they usually go to the theatre once a week at least. We'd go to the National Theatre, for example, and we'd go and see, you know, show at the Olivier or something like that. And I really strongly remember driving up into town from the suburbs where I grew up and going for a meal and seeing a show, and that being kind of like it stopped being like a treat, and I don't mean that in a bad way, and it became like it became part of my cultural life, if that makes sense. Which I'm incredibly grateful for, because it made theatre a space where I felt welcome. You know, and then by the time I was like 16 and 17 and studying theatre at school, I was like starting to choose what I wanted to see, and kind of had much more control of that. And then going to a little interesting fringe theatre, so what used to be the Tricycle and is now the Kiln, or like going to the Arcola for the first time and seeing stuff that was really like my choice and kind of cool and interesting, you know. But yeah, it wasn't like a theatre never felt scary or odd. I didn't come to it late. It was very much like classic. I used to do drama class as a kid. I've always been comfortable in theatres and was probably a show off as a kid. I used to wanted to be an actor. Years was like, oh, when I'm an actor, then didn't become one, which is probably the best thing I did, even though I felt very disappointing at the time.
And I mean, you've spoken a bit about, you've just spoken about obviously having theatre in your life quite a lot. So was there a point that you decided to sort of actively pursue it as a career, and then how that's kind of taken you to where you are now? I mean, you've spoken a bit about it, but if you
can. I think the funny thing is, it's I don't really think I thought too much about it, and that's probably to a detriment. So like when I went to school, it was a school where you were just expected to go to uni. There wasn't like a question of, is this what you'd like to do, what are the alternatives, what are the other options? It was a school, I really enjoyed my school, but it was very traditional. It was like you go to Oxbridge or Warwick, or you know, study something sensible like PPE, you know, go and join go be a doctor or something like that, you know.
Mm.
So I just sort of went to my drama and English teacher, Mr. Brown, who's still like one of the most influential people in my life.
Yeah.
And said, I think I want to do drama. Should I go be an actor or should I go to university? He was like, we'll probably go to university because it gives you a degree that's flexible. And he just said, you should look at these four universities.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to them and went to one, and I didn't really think about it. I just sort of, I mean, I worked very hard to get there. It wasn't like it sort of was plain sailing, but I didn't overanalyze it. And the same thing when I left uni, I was like, well, I'd do some acting because I did loads of plays, and I was like, well, I'd love to be an actor, so I should probably try that. And then was incredibly lucky to get into Lambda.
Mm.
And that was the first time I really actually analyzed what I was doing and properly was failing on my ass. Like, I was really failing at drama school. Oh God, I was so anxious. I was so anxious because, like, you can't win at drama school. And I think I'd just gone to so many, like, I'd gone to a boys' private school that was very, very supportive and brilliant in many ways,
mm.
but was very much like, your grades are very important, your success is very important. And was very privileged and lucky to have been able to afford to go there and all the rest of it. And I went to uni, similarly, very privileged, very lucky to have gone there. But it was, you know, it was academic. You know, it was like you've got to meet your goals and do well. And I did pretty well. And then I went to drama school and it's like, none of that matters because you're like learning how to breathe. And I remember we did a class or like, you know, be a fish or like, you know, like, act like you're made out of rubber and you're like, what is this? Like, and I remember we did a movement class. We were asked to bring in two lines from a Shakespeare sonnet, the opening lines of a Shakespeare sonnet. I think I took in My Mistress's Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun, Coral Is More Red Than Her Lips Red, which is a funny sonnet, I think. And the movement teacher, she asked us to lie down on the ground and pick five of the words from that we liked.
Mm.
And then we had to start with one of them and say it with our toes. So I'm lying there on the floor, my eyes closed. This is terrible podcast content because I'm going to do some miming now. But like I was wiggling my toes, going, coral, coral, tapping my toes and being like, coral, coral, coral. Have I done that right? And this is all going on in my head. Have I done that right? I think I'm doing it right. Am I winning? What is winning? What am I doing here? Why am I paying to come here? Oh my God. Then she's going, okay, now say it with your shins. I'm like, I can't even say it on my toes. How am I supposed to do it with my shins? The shin isn't flexible. It's a bone. Now with your knees. Hang on. What about the shins? You know, and this is all happening in my head. And then at one point she was like, and now you should be on your feet and you should just be like letting out pure sound. No, no words, just like the sound of the word, but not the word. I'm like, how do you do that? I don't fucking. I'm still lying on the floor flapping my feet like a landed tuna on a trawler deck going coral, coral. And then I was like, just stand up in my head. I'm like, just stand up. So I got to my feet and said, just look at someone across the room. Look at what they're doing and copy them. Just get through this class.
Yeah.
And I opened my eyes and my friend was standing there rubbing her boobs going, woo, 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 and rolling around. And I just went, I'm out.
No, thank you.
I just went, no, thank you. I've got a headache. And I literally walked out of the class. I literally just walked out. And it was kind of like that for 2 years of just me resisting a lot and going, I should be an actor. And because I think I'm good. I don't know, but I want to do this. I love making theatre and I love being in them and stuff. And
yeah.
I came out and I just like, oh, I'm every time we had like a break in the court, you know, the end of term break, I would find a theatre to work for or a theatre company to work for. Outside of acting. So I volunteered at Hampstead Theatre with the Camden University doing a summer school with the young people.
Mm.
And I worked with the Oval House Theatre with their young people and doing lots of that, just developing other skills. And when I left, I actually asked the director of the show I was in, I said, could you hook me up with any contacts in theatres? Because I'm really keen to like, I had this idea of becoming an artistic director or running a theatre.
Mm.
And he hooked me up with someone at Shared Experience and I started being an admin assistant there. And I just spent like 2 years doing every other job except acting.
Mm.
I genuinely think if you want to work in theatre, you can tell a director who's never acted.
Mm.
You can tell an actor who has never worked backstage. You can tell a producer who's never written, you know, like the best people in theatre are people who've done other jobs. So you having been on stage when you were younger.
Yeah.
Know what it is to be asked to do something on stage and can sympathize and appreciate that. And an actor who has trained, who's been asked to go manage the board in their university theatre company or who has had to make costumes or produce their own Edinburgh show. It's just that bit kinder, I think. Yeah,
much more accepting of other people's jobs and much more kind of...
patient.
Sympathetic yeah. and patient and just has an awareness and an understanding of what other people need, I think, yeah.
So I was really adamant to do as many different jobs in theatre as possible. And I started going back into acting again. And I did a show. I was doing... So at one point I was working as a development assistant at Soho Theatre, which was a company I really enjoyed working for. I wasn't destined to be a development assistant, or, you know, but I loved the company. I loved the theatre. It was a brilliant place to work. I was working in Soho in the centre of town. It was great fun. The people there were lovely. But I was also like itchy feet. Like, this isn't creative. This is administrative. And it's not where my skills lie or where my passion lies. So I started... At one point, I was acting in two shows whilst doing a 9-to-5 job. It was two like open air Shakespeare's that were going around the private gardens of and parks of London.
Yeah.
Really good fun. Spent a whole summer, you know, biking here and there doing Taming of the Shrew and Macbeth, and whilst also holding down a 9-to-5. Yeah. I blessed Soho Theatre because they were incredibly flexible with me. I couldn't have done that without them being so considerate. And then I produced two shows at the Hoxton Hall, beautiful old Victorian music hall. And then I thought, I've never written a play. I'll do that. So I quit my full-time job and got a job in Soho Theatre as a box office assistant and just started writing. I think it was because I'd done so many jobs where I was like sick and tired of doing Fringe Shakespeare and Fringe Wild. And because, you know, the fact is when I came out of drama school, I was just another well-spoken, posh white man. And our industry was saturated with them. There's just a lot of us.
Yeah.
And very unfairly, there is a lot of us as well, I should add. But I wasn't anything... A friend of mine once said to me, you're a good actor, but you're a better writer, which was the nicest compliment I got, because I credit myself with being a good writer. I hope I'm a good writer, you know. And there are days when I genuinely go, yeah, I'm fucking brilliant at this. Yeah. Bow, 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 bow. And there's other days where I'm like, why am I doing this? I should do something else. I was like, I want to write something that I think is important and has something interesting to say. So I just started. That's really it. I just like went, fuck it. I'm going to write my own play. And for a long time, it was a really stupid idea. it still is a stupid idea working in the arts. But the best ideas are stupid ideas. Like, no.
Well, yeah, quite.
No good stories come from a sensible idea. You know?
Well, exactly.
So yeah, I just started and I put it on at a theatre, the Canal Cafe Theatre, in fact. I wrote a play, which was a horror about someone coming back from the first Iraq war who may or may not be a vampire.
Right.
Or maybe someone with PTSD. I got five friends from drama school to be in it. I invited 50 people, friends and family and stuff, and some people I knew in theatre, and put down, I think, 150 quid to rent a space and just put on a reading. And I'll tell you how badly organised it was. When I got there, I didn't realise it only had an hour slot, not a 90-minute slot. So an hour into the play, I just had to turn to the audience and go, so apparently we've just run out of time. So yeah, if you want to know how it ends, come to me in the bar. And a lovely director called Ollie Rose literally did say, I really enjoyed that. Let's chat. And he was looking to do something at the King's Head for these sort of three one-off nights. With the theatre was quiet on a Sunday night. So they were like, we'll put things on. And we did three Sundays in a row, I think it was. It was the first thing I ever did. And I was like, well, someone thinks I'm interesting. I got like a little... it was a proper run of the show, if that makes sense. Even though it was only three nights, but it was like fully produced and the rest of it, you know. I've literally just kept going. I'm just going to keep going until someone tells me to shut the fuck up, at which point I would probably become like an old angry white man and go, my point of view is valid.
Yeah, and just take to Twitter instead.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I don't turn into Lawrence Fox, that's the only thing.
Exactly.
But yes, so that's kind of how it started. But I do think I was an okay actor. But training as an actor made me a better writer. Because in the same way that we were saying about, you know, you're more sympathetic, I was like, I know what sounds right and I know what sounds wrong.
Yes, yeah.
And you must have this as somebody who works with, you know, when you are sat in the room and you watch a director and an actor working, there must be times when your instinct just goes, well, that's the answer.
Mm, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. And I sit there and I go, I can't say anything. I can't say anything.
It must have been really frustrating.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not your job. Your job is to help the thing happen, not to say how it should happen.
Yeah, exactly. That is very
frustrating. Have you ever been tempted to like jump on the other side of things and like make stuff for yourself?
No, I don't think I'm much better being the sort of doer, but like the doer for somebody else. Like I'm
the
much
facilitator.
Better. Yeah, the facilitator. That's it. That's it. The facilitator. I'm not very good at like having the gumption to just like be the kind of creator, I don't think. She said, as having started a podcast, very different.
Yeah, hang on.
Very different sat in my own bedroom.
Yeah, that's true. You are a creator, but it's a different kind of thing.
It's different. It's very different.
But it's also a brilliant skill, like, because I think that like it requires a huge amount of curiosity, you know, like. I think that look at some of the people you've chatted to, and you chat to some great people, but also people who aren't necessarily like, I don't know, you're not talking to like Lucien Mesmarty and Fiona Shaw. You're talking to like, have you talked to Pete, who's the lighting, he does lighting.
At the Globe.
He used to work at the Globe. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the fact that you've talked to him and just been like, this is what it's actually like to work. Well, at Holly in costume, like, this is what it's actually like to work in theatre, I think is a really, a really lovely model for a show. Because I think a lot, that was one thing. When I was at Lambda, Lambda's a very old-fashioned drama school. And it, in my opinion, needs a lot of change, like a lot of the drama schools. Because the one thing they constantly were saying to you was, when you were at the BBC doing your show, you know, when you're in Line of Duty, or when you're in Doctors, or when you're at the Olivier, this is what they do. They never say to you, when you're unemployed and working two other jobs and trying to get a show reel together, or when you're doing profit share panto in Bridlington. They're never honest about being creative, and nor did they say to us, make your own work. So if you look at a company like Mischief, who made the play that goes wrong.
Oh yes, yeah I know
Scamp?
Who you mean.
Scamp's,
I don't know,
different. Scamp's a children's theatre company. Mischief, who made play that goes wrong, were a bunch of Lambda grads, I think, who A, were very good, and B, got very lucky, but they made their own stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like they went and did it, and like, so I was at drama school with, do you know the stand-up Aisling B?
Yes.
So I trained with her, and I think she similarly had a lot of difficulties at drama school, like everyone does, because it's a nightmare. And I'm sure you had the same thing when you were at Central, like drama school, insane, like it's an awful place in many respects, whilst also being fabulous in other respects. But she was always, once we graduated, and I think while we were at drama school, she was working and being a stand-up and doing things. And that's why partly she's got to where she's got to, not just because of a talent she has, or she works. She just makes her own content. And I think that's the thing they never tell you, is make your own stuff. Or they never tell you that you won't necessarily be at the front of the creative process, but you can still be within the creative process, even if that's like marketing or fundraising or something. You know, they never go to you, you're training to be an actor, but you need to think of yourself, like 99% of you will not be actors, 99% of you will, like, you know, 80% of you won't do this ever again, and then 20% of you will do it, but like you'll be backstage or in the office or writing, or, you know, like, and I wish they had the honesty to say that. I know, well, they didn't, because they're a business, and if they tell people, please give us thousands of pounds to fail,
you're not going to be this thing. But
my dad was really like, I don't understand, I thought they got you an agent, I thought all this happened, and I think I did to a degree too. I was like, sorry, where's my career? Have I done what you asked? And of course I wasn't going to get a career straight away, but like, also I wish they'd just been more honest. Oh, and I say this about all drama schools, I just wish they would be honest, but I know why they're not, because if they did, no one would go, and the whole thing would fall apart.
You were speaking a little bit about your kind of structure in your day, and kind of when you're writing, and how you and that process for you. And I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about that in terms of how you would go about writing a play. Do you have certain things that you always do, or is it quite sort of different per time that you do it? You know, could you tell me a bit about that?
There's certain things that are consistent, and I often talk to people about this, and they ask me about it. You know, I remember someone asking me, like, what's your routine? So a big one for me is like, I've got perfect day. This is like a perfect day for me as a writer, right? Get up at 8 o'clock, because that's the joy of working theatre, is that you can get up when the fuck you like. I would do yoga and exercises in the morning and stretch out my body because I spend all day hunched up over a desk. And then I would have a long bath because I love a bath. And then I'd have breakfast and then I'd get dressed. And for me, actually getting dressed is a very important thing. Like, I think an identity is quite important for a writer. Like, someone can go, or any creative in theatre, actually, go like, I remember hearing a story about a producer, British producer who went to Hollywood, and his wife said to him, you should wear bright red socks and just make that your thing. So he would always go to meetings and stuff wearing these bright red socks. And he was always known as the guy with bright red socks. People were like, oh, Peter, yes, he go with bright red socks. Yeah, it was just a thing. Mm. So like, I always wear a suit if I can, or a variation on a suit. I love ties and waistcoats and pocket squares and all that kind of jazz. I do my hair, I trim my beard. Like, I take a lot of care and effort because for me, that's not just I like to look nice, but it's uniform. In the same way that, like, it's you go to work in an office or, you know, frontline, you know, customer service or catering, you have to look the part. Presentable, yeah, and that's very important for me. So that's a big thing. And it's also like a branding thing. So people know, oh, Tristan, he's very smart. I recognize him, you know, kind of like, and that's useful from a branding point of view. People can kind of remember you. You're not just another white dude with a beard. You're like, oh, the white dude with a beard, but he's got lovely suits.
Yes.
Things like that, you know? I remember him.
Mm.
Then I would go to, so I write from the London Library, which is a members library in the centre of town, just behind the Waterstones on Piccadilly. Which sounds very fancy and it is lovely, but it's not like a sort of members club. You just pay, anyone can become a member. And in fact, they do fantastic, reductions for people, for students. Mm-hmm. And also if you're like, oh, they have bursaries and stuff. So you're like, I can't afford the full price. They'll go, well, we can give you up to 50% off if you tell us your circumstances. And they're incredibly generous. And that was a real game changer. So I go there and I liked each play or screenplay or whatever I write, I like to find a new spot in the library.
Mm-hmm.
I find a different spot and I'm like, this is where I, so I could point to you in the library and go, that's where I wrote that thing.
What and happens if somebody's sitting there one day?
Well, this is the thing. You have to kind of get there at the right time. It's a bit like, I know people who write from the British Library and there's the British Library is, because it's also free, it's a bit of a bun fight to get in and there's not enough plugs and stuff. But to go back to the London Library, I find a spot and if someone's in it, I have to begrudgingly find somewhere else and then try and get there early the next day.
Yeah.
But I then have a little locker there because you can get little lockers. I lock away my phone and I have a little old laptop that can't access the internet.
Nice.
And that's, I think that's very,
very
important.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I've really struggled this year is writing from home is that the internet's just there.
Mm.
Like, I don't have that. I'm quite disciplined about turning off the internet. And, you know, obviously I go to the computers and use them research and there'll be times when I'm just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna go and text people for 20 minutes.
Yeah,
but in order to do that I have to leave and go.
Yeah, it's an active decision.
It's an active choice.
Oh, I found myself on,
exactly,
you know,
like the amount of times this like last couple of months I've just been like on Facebook or Instagram and bit, you know, and been like, what am I doing? Just it's hard, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'll probably work for 3 hours a day writing. And I would rather do like 3 solid hours of writing than an 8-hour day, like a proper 9-to-5. Because I'm just like, no one. Even when I worked in an office, I wasn't working full time. You know, you work 4 hours a day. The other half of the day is spent on making tea and watching cat videos. You know, like that's a reality of work. Then I go and teach in the evenings. So I would write for 3 hours, then try and do some more exercise or have lunch. And then I'd go and tutor. So I tutor young students, exams, and things like that. So I teach in the evening. And then yesterday I'd go dinner, movie, theatre, friends, you know, like I think that's very important and they just kind of keep that cycle going. So it's very, there are certain things that I think are really important. Like for me, a uniform is really important. A place away from your home is really important. A fairly rigid but also flexible structure. I think it's very important to be able to leave your work in a space that's not your home. When I first started writing, I was writing from my kitchen table and I was just doing any time I could grab. It was completely unsustainable. You know, I was writing until like 4 in the morning. And it was very exciting. You're like, yeah, I feel like Kerouac. Oh, my hair's all over the place and I'm just crazy writing. But you're like, you can't do that forever because you die of exhaustion. You've kind of got to treat it like a job. So I think that there's an element there where that has been the biggest struggle this year, I think, for me, my routine being disrupted. And for all of us, you know, because I can still technically write. You know, the great thing about writing is that you can do it with a pen and a pencil. That's literally all you need. Yes, a computer is lovely. Yes, of course, but you don't need it. But you build a routine. And I would say anyone who wants to write, find out the routine that works for you. So like I know lots of people who love to write for coffee shops. I know a friend of mine, Jess Sean, wrote I think she wrote her play Clippies on the bus. She used to just get on the bus and just travel the route. And I love that. I love hearing about how writers write.
Yeah.
Because everyone's different. Mm. And everyone's, no one has the correct method. It's just the method that works for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you, as well as writing plays, you've also done adaptations, haven't you? So I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about how that works, adapting kind of a story into a play.
Yeah, so I've done a couple of adaptations. So I did Frankenstein, and I also did Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, which was a really mad one. That was really fun. That was crazy. So the Frankenstein one was Ellie Rode, who directed Teddy and Boudicca. Fantastic director, really brilliant. She calls me up and goes, do you want to adapt Frankenstein? I've been asked by the Watermill to do their education tour. So the idea is they do 30 shows in lots of different secondary schools around the area. You know, literally go into their school halls, set up a tiny stage sort of thing and do a GCSE text.
Yeah.
And it's all a way for the theatre to make some money and, you know, kind of do their education stuff. And I was like, yeah, I love Frankenstein. I'm a huge fan of it. I love horror. I love sci-fi. Frankenstein is like the prototypical horror sci-fi. I could do that. Easy peasy. So we went and did a couple of days workshop, and which was really good fun. And it came quite easily and quite quickly because you've got this thing there. You've got the story. And the good thing about Frankenstein is it's I would say the story of Frankenstein is better than the book. It is a brilliant, it is an unimpeachably brilliant myth that's inside an okay book. Because it was written by a 17-year-old. And who at 17 was like, she created the most extraordinary idea that is bigger and more interesting than the book itself. You know, like the book has got, like Dracula. The Book of Dracula, in my opinion, is quite a boring, turgid book. But the concept of the Count Dracula is so brilliant that everyone knows it throughout the world, even if they've not read the book. And then when they read the book, they go, oh, God, it's this really like bleeding, moralizing, woe begotten kind of turgid piece of Victorian awfulness. It's just terribly boring. Whereas Frankenstein's kind of burgeoning and sexy and mad and romantic, even in very flawed, hugely flawed. But the creature is really interesting. And he's always the best bit. So we sort of started with the creature, and we decided to sort of start with, and actually the beginning of the show was kind of found in the room, mostly by Ellie, the director, Tom Jackson Greaves, who's a phenomenal moving director and choreographer, absolutely amazing, and a brilliant actor called Brian Martin, who's also brilliant, and they just played around with these scenes, and then I was writing stuff in the other room, and then we'd come back and share things, and they came up with this idea of, we'd sort of started the idea, it'd be fun to start with the birth of the creature, and we knew that we had a budget thing, which is we could only afford two actors, and the Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch was like, they're each going to play the doctor and the creature and swap. And I was like, well, what if just one person played the creature and Frankenstein, and then the second person does everyone else? You know, that was a kind of, I thought, an interesting concept. And then once they'd sort of made that opening section and developed it, I was like, okay, and then I went and wrote that, and then I was like, okay, and then I can just build on writing it, and I just wrote the rest of it. It just kind of came very easily because there's this structure there, and because it's a one-person show, you just tell the story, and you've got this very clear voice because the creature learned to speak from reading Milton, so he's got this Miltonian excess that's kind of beautiful to read and sort of a high register of kind of iambic epic poetry. And it sort of came quite easily, and it sort of helps. You've got this thing, and the key thing is not to be precious. So if someone's not useful, just get rid of it. Like Mary Shelley's been dead for hundreds of years, she's not going to mind. And also like Frankenstein is so much part of the kind of cultural landscape that you can do what you like. It's been done so many fucking times, you've just got to play with it, you know. Like,
yeah,
I think by the point you get to a blaxploitation Frankenstein, which I think they did a blaxploitation Frankenstein, if not I'd be disappointed, then you're like, that's fantastic, because it's just become so kind of part of the moment Scooby-Doo meets Frankenstein, you know that you're allowed to play with it, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
there's so many brilliant, extraordinary, wonderful different permutations of it, so you can just play with it. And the weird thing about that show is we did it at the Watermill for a week, and then we went into this run of shows at the schools. And then they were like, oh, we're going to take it to London for a short run at that music hall in East London. I've completely forgotten the name of Wilton's Music Hall.
Wilton's, yeah.
To Wilton's, which was lovely. And then last year, summer of 2019, my agent got in touch and said, have you got Frankenstein, the script? It was my agent's assistant, actually, Carolyn. She was like, have you got the script? I was like, oh, yeah. I thought she just wanted it for the files or something. And then my agent got in touch and said, so this theatre company in New York would like to do it off Broadway. Because basically they were doing a double bill of Frankenstein and Dracula, and the writer who was supposed to deliver Frankenstein was unable to meet a deadline just because he just, sometimes it happens, you know, you're like, with all the best will in the world, you just can't find a way to make it work. You can't find a way. They were just looking for a script, and John Doyle, who runs the theatre, the Classic Stage Company, used to work, I think he used to work, definitely, he was an associate at the Watermill, and heard about this from the grapevine. They asked to read it and they liked it. So I got to go to New York with this show, which was fucking, so it's, the weirdest thing is it started out as like a, in, you know, these classrooms in Berkshire.
Yeah.
And ended up off Broadway. And I was like, that's mad. So that was a really like fun gift of a show, because it just got me lots of fun adventures, you know, off the back of it. But I think the key thing was like, it was kind of easy to adapt because you've got the story sort of there. And then I did this adaptation of Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, which is itself an adaptation of the H.G. Wells. So it's a prog. I did a immersive virtual reality adaptation of a progressive rock album adaptation of a Victorian science fiction novel, which is one of my favorite novels.
Wow. So
I love the album for all its glorious success. And that was really good fun, because actually that was kind of like writing a video game. Because you couldn't write it like a regular play. It was sort of like halfway between writing a play and halfway between writing a video game. It was really good fun. But again, you have a very strict, in that one, we had other things. It wasn't just the story, but it was the songs. The music of Jeff Wayne had to be in there because it's such a cult thing, whether you like it or not. And I do like it. It's fun. It's campy 70s prog rock. It's like the opening of War of the Worlds is so like, dun, dun, dun. It's so kind of brilliantly, madly iconic. But you're sort of got this spine to work off, so you're just fleshing, and then you can play around. And that one was a slightly different job, because it was very much their thing that I was hired, very much like a gun for hire, so I was a lot less precious. And actually I was like, I'll do my job, and as you know, obviously these people get the final say, you know, at the end of the day, Jeff Wayne, it's his product, he gets the final say, so you know, he gets to say what he likes and what he doesn't like, which is in some ways tricky, but you also just got to go, well, you hired me, you're paying me. I'm a gun for hire. I really enjoyed the project. I was very proud, but it wasn't one that I wasn't willing to die on it. Do you know what I mean? So like adapting is really good fun. I'd love to do more of it because you've got something there and all you do is bring your flavor to it. It solves a lot of the hardest parts of, like, I'm writing something at the moment and I'm really struggling. Cause I'm just like, I just don't know what happens next. I just don't know what happens next. I'm being driven mad by it. Whereas if it's already been written, I could just go, that obviously happens next. You do that thing next.
Yeah.
And find the best way to do it. But yeah, it is fun because you get to put your own flavor on it, and the sort of half the hard work's done for you.
Yeah. It must be hard to select the kind of the bits that you want to. I mean, obviously there's the kind of through line storyline, which you have to, in some ways you have to honor, but then it must be hard to kind of select all the stuff around that to put your stamp on it.
I think you just got, but also you just got to be ruthless, because like there are certain bits you have to do because people know those bits. I don't know, if you were to adapt, if you did Frozen on stage and then never did Let It Go, that's insane, because that's the only good part of that film apart from the ending.
Wait, hang on.
I'm not a fan of Frozen. Well, I'm not a fan of Frozen.
Sorry.
I'll tell you what, Frozen is not for me. I wouldn't say it's a bad movie.
Very good.
I'd say it's a film I think is for a much younger audience. I'm interested. It's not like, for example, Princess and the Frog, which is fantastic.
Great film.
Such a great film.
Great film.
But when you're adapting things, like, there are things you have to do. You have to do the hits, you know. But also the good thing about Frankenstein is most people haven't read Frankenstein.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So I would love to move on now to the quick fire questions section. These are questions that you haven't seen before. So if you're ready, I will jump in with my first question, which is possibly a fairly niche question that might be a bit tough, but who knows? Let's go for it. What is your favorite ever stage direction? Now, this can be one that you've written or one that you've read in another play. Up to you.
This is a great question because I love a good stage direction. Many years ago, I was told by a director, most of the time director will cut a stage direction, because I used to write these very Byzantine complex stage directions, the likes of which that, you know, Miller or Shaw would write. But obviously when Shaw or Ibsen were writing these stage directions, plays were read at home amongst friends, you know, they were it's like reading a book out loud, you know. now we don't do that. So there's no point in having the stage directions. They basically were like, unless you can make an offer that I cannot refuse, don't put the stage direction in.
Mm.
So I've got a couple of my stage directions that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
That I'm very proud of. So like there's one in Teddy, which is they kiss. It might be the greatest kiss ever. And that's nice. Just like, do what you want with that. Or like when Johnny Valentine arrives on stage, it said, Johnny Valentine enters. It's as if the morning star has arrived on stage. You know, it's just the concept of that. Like, however you want to do it, it's just like, fuck, he's here, is the kind of concept. Mm. Then when we did Boudicca, there was a stage direction which was the two armies fight and it's as if the island will crack in half. Wow. And you're like, you know, we gave that to Ellie, and I gave it to Ellie, and then Ellie gave it to Arciani, who's in Rachel, the incredible choreographers. And we're just like, have at it. Like, I just want it to be amazing. Whatever it is, just be brilliant. But you can do whatever the fuck you want.
Mm.
I love giving those stage directions to people. But other people's stage directions, there are some brilliant ones. Like there's a really good Philip Ridley one where he says that a character looks like a shark dipped in Vaseline. I think it's that. And that might be the fastest clock in the universe. I think it's a great one. There's obviously the classic one from The Royal Hunt from the Sun, the Shaffer play, which is they cross the Andes. And you're like, brilliant. Or like, you know, the...
Good.
Yeah, good. Done. Go. And cue across the Andes. And then like... there's the Sarah Kane famous one, which is like she eats the baby, you know, stuff like that. But I love a stage direction that is an impossible, delicious offer that no one... Oh, there's a really good one now that I can't remember who wrote it. And I think the line is something like, they suddenly get it. And it's in the middle of like a relationship argument.
Mm.
And they suddenly get it. Just goes... it's like the character just goes, oh, fuck. And everything just like slots into place. I'll tell you one of the best ones. It's a film stage direction, actually, which is from With Nell and I. I think this is the best one. And it's which Bruce Robinson wrote and directed. And it's they say that, what is it? It's something like they say that hell is a room with one chair, a room with two people and one chair. This room has no chairs. It's something like that. It's absolutely... It's just such a brilliant offer. It tells you nothing and tells you everything at the same time. I think those are my favourite ones.
Yeah.
I think those are the best ones. Mm. Yeah.
Brilliant. I love that. What items do you always have on your desk or workstation?
Oh, okay. So I'm going to look in front of me and see what I've got now. So this is something I always have on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little cast iron octopus called Archie.
Nice.
Who's like my little writing mascot on my desk. He sits there with me. Then this is another thing I've got. I've always got a pile of books in the London Library. And then I've got this as well, which is a... So the desk I work from is my grandfather's desk. It's like an old... Mm-hmm. I'll show you what it looks like. Again, great stuff for
great,
listeners.
Great for a podcast.
Great content. It's an old,
writing desk.
Fold-down bureau.
Yeah.
It's a proper old bureau.
Mm.
And... Well, my dad gave it to me because it was his father's desk, and he moved surgeries. He was a dentist, and when he moved surgery, he was like, oh, I don't need it anymore. So can I have it? I said, yeah, of course. And I found in behind one of the drawers, a check written by my grandfather.
Oh, wow.
Like an old check from 1957, I believe, for seven shillings. And that sits on the desk as well. And
that's
a pair
amazing.
Of dice that I got on the night walk with Inua Ellams. Lots of like tchotchkes and little, you know, knickknacks and things. And there's like a photo of my mum and my brother there and me and my grandpa. And there's lots of that stuff. But when I'm at the London Library, I like a really clean desk. So I like to keep my I don't like stuff. But I will try and have like a notebook, my fountain pen, my pencil case. So yeah, that kind of little tchotchke. But I like to keep my desk kind of clean because I like a clean space.
Yeah, yeah.
Around my head, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense.
It's hard. I find it very hard to work in a busy space. Like I need to, when I go to write, I spend about half an hour like slowly getting ready to. Yeah, and like I remember, I think Philip Ridley talked about this. Like writing is a bit like diving. You can't just go down to the depths too quickly. It's dangerous. You have to spend like half an hour going down in stages. Yeah. And then when you're at the bottom, you've probably got like an hour of really like going through the weird, mucky stuff of your imagination, where all the little weird deep sea creatures and the oil and precious gems and minerals are. and then you have to come back out. But similarly, if you come straight back out of writing for like an hour after having really in the zone, you are just a weird person to talk to. So you need to come out slowly. So I think a lot of writing is actually prepping to write and then decompressing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And for me, a part of that process is clearing a space and finding a clean area, if that kind of makes sense. So those are the kind of things, like when I'm at home, those knickknacks, those tchotchkes. But when I'm at the library, it's very clean. Sort of space.
That's really interesting. Really interesting. What is your biggest theatre faux pas or confession?
I was once watching a play that was so boring, I put on a podcast.
No.
Yeah.
I can't believe that.
Yeah. I once did that.
I'm not going to ask you what the play was, but what was the podcast?
It was the Kermode & Mayo podcast.
Very good. Very good.
Good
choice.
It was in another city, so it wasn't mine. Mm-hmm. It wasn't London, my home. Somewhere else, and I went to watch this play. No one I knew was in it. Like, it was very much doing its thing, and I was there. Mm. I had to be there because I was with some people, and I couldn't just go.
Yeah.
And it was awful. So, and it wasn't just the production, it was the play. It's a dreadful play. So I was like, well, if I'm stuck here, it was so boring.
Might as well enjoy myself.
I couldn't sleep. It was that boring. Have you ever seen a show that's so boring? You must have fallen asleep in the theatre, right?
Yes.
I don't think that's really a faux pas. But yeah, it was so boring I couldn't fall asleep.
Wow.
Play was so crushingly dull. Very famous play, very famous actors, very famous director, very prestigious theatre. So bored I put in a podcast. It's terrible. It's a terrible thing to confess.
That is brilliant.
But I will counterbalance this by saying something that happened to me. So when we did Boudicca at the Globe, final night at the Globe, arguably the most successful thing in my career. Really exciting.
I saw it. It was incredible.
Oh, thanks, man. That's really kind.
Incredible.
Like, it was a real, like, how that one came about is bonkers, but like the luck, I mean, it was just such a lucky turn of events that got me there. But the final night, huge standing ovation. People, and the last night at the Globe is always special because, like, all the actors come out and they throw, I mean, you were there, you know, like people throw out the, you have worked there, right? I'm not imagining.
Yeah.
People throw out roses and there's a real sense of occasion. And the Globe itself is brilliant as a space. When it works, the Globe is amazing, but when it doesn't, it dies on its ass. It's a really tough space, but when it's good, it's amazing. And I think we did a really good job, and I put that a lot down to Ellie and a lot of the choices she made. But huge animation, everyone's clapping, way, you know, rounds of applause, and coming back on, they had like, you know, four curtain calls or something in the end, and it all died down and people started to clear out, and I was like, wow, that was like the run of my show, that was incredible. And two rows in front of me, a guy just turned to his wife and goes, well, that was bollocks. So, you know, I'm sure someone's fallen asleep and put on a podcast in my show. So, yeah, it's fine by me.
Yep. Well, that's a very great conclusion to the quickfire questions.
What do I win? What's my prize?
Yeah. Oh, I'll have to think about that.
Is it an Olivier? Just pull one off the shelf.
Oh. Ta-da, one I found earlier. So I'd love to talk to you now about theatre in a more kind of general sense. So I was wondering if you could tell me what has been your proudest moment while working in theatre?
Probably Boudicca. That was one I was like, oh no, actually. I mean, yes, but I mean, obviously it's Boudicca because it was the biggest thing I did. And one of the biggest theatres in London, you know, because it's because you've got 700 standing already. You know,
yeah.
Pretty fucking exciting. That was a really like wow moment, like seeing your name on a poster. And like, I'm really in, and like, it's very vain of me, but I'm really into all the stuff that's like, there's my name in a book, there's my, like getting my
It's so exciting,
published, you know, those things. But I think one of the moments that I found really exciting was I was sat on the South Bank, my dad and my brother, during the first run of Teddy at the Southwark, and my brother had just bought my dad and I a present for our Christmas, which was to go on like a, you know, those speed boats that go down the Thames, the rigid inflatable boats. Huge fun, very stupid. They played like Queen and, you know, fucking Journey, like full volume as you're zipping along the Thames to go visit the Thames barrier. They're like, don't stop believing.
You know, very annoying like, when you're doing a show in the Globe.
Oh, like, yeah, hugely.
Those things go past and you're like, oh, God.
Fuckers. Anyway, so afterwards we sat, we're having a drink on the South Bank at the Understudy. And my dad was like, what are you going to do next? And because Teddy was going very nicely and successful. And I was like, well, I don't know. You know, I've had these ideas. And my dad is like, my dad is, I should precede this by saying my dad is one of the most supportive people. He's been so supportive, both emotionally, financially, practically, like an incredibly supportive man. But he is a dentist. He is not an artist. And he approaches things with a slightly more business head. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you've got to do something that's going to make you known. You've got to do like, you've got to have a hit. People need to know you. Otherwise, you know, what you're doing, like people need to know who you are. And that exact moment he said that, someone walked by and went, excuse me, are you Tristan Bernays? And I went, yeah. And he went, I saw Teddy last night. And he's like, I've still got the program in my bag. And I recognized your photo from the program.
Wow. Yeah.
And just started being incredibly effusive and nice. At which point my brother looked at my dad and was like, see? So that was a really like funny moment of just like pride that I was being recognized. But like, I think categorically it would be Boudica, because it was just such a big, it was so big. The stuff we got to do in that show is absurd. You know, we were like, can we have people zip line? There was only one thing we couldn't do, and it wasn't because we weren't allowed, because of like, it was basically a practical thing. Like, if we wanted to do this thing, which was to have people running around on zip wires, it would literally smash into the lights.
Yeah.
So we were like, well, can we just have people zip lining on the stage? And they're like, yeah. There was nothing they wouldn't let us do, pretty much.
Yeah.
That was pretty fucking exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say are the benefits of working in a creative industry?
I was talking about this with my friend today. I went out for a walk before we started recording this, and he's was a human rights lawyer, now works in the Home Office, but he's always worked in sort of that world of law and human rights and very, very big, serious stuff. Very serious. Like some of the stuff he's dealt with in his life is incredible professionally. Like, I just don't know how he does it. And years ago, I was like, I don't know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I feel like art is a waste of time. I should be doing something more useful. And he said, well, no, my job is to make the world a better place. Your job is to make it worth making a better place. Like, you know, I do all the stuff like helping people who've been separated from their families, or deal with like literal war conflict legalities, or helping people who've been trafficked or whatever. That's my job. Then I come home and I want to go and see something that makes the world worth fighting for. Art, theatre, music, food. That's your job. And that for me was a very exciting moment to be sort of someone to go, what you do is valid.
Yeah.
That was really important.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then the big question, what in your opinion is the best thing about theatre?
People. It's the people. Mm. Like without a shadow of a doubt. Like obviously, yes, the stories, the you know, it's a night out, but like, it's very wanky to say this, but for me, theatre is the closest thing I have to a church. Mm. So I used to go to church when I was a kid. I used to go to a very nice Church of England, hello, sort of tea and cake with the vicar kind of place. And I never really believed in God, I think, now I think about it. But what I really liked was the community.
Yeah.
And I'm an atheist now, and that doesn't bother me. But what I do miss is the community, that sense of like going somewhere with a combined purpose. And the most important thing for me is that social communal aspect, like being together, seeing something, seeing your friends, seeing your colleagues. Yes, it's a business. Yes, it's an industry. But at its heart, theatre is something more than that. It comes from a religious background. It comes from a space where we try and explore. Even I think, unless I'm mistaken, the etymology of the word proscenium, like the proscenium arch, comes from the proscenium. And the scenium was the backdrop that they would use in ancient Greek religious services. So like I'm probably talking out my ass. And if I am, then someone much more intelligent than me can tell me I'm talking a lot of bullshit. But my understanding was, much like when I was a kid and go to church, we would act out stories in the Bible. So, you know, we'd go this week the vicar's doing a sermon about the feeding of the 5,000. We're going to do a scene from that and we're going to act it out. That's what they used to do in ancient Greece. You know, that's what they used to do. All these cultures have done that. And that's where it comes from. You're just like, these are our stories and these are our religious beliefs. Let's act it out. You pretend to be Zeus. You pretend to be Adonis, whatever, you know, whatever characters you want to be. And then we'll act this scene out. And then one day they go, well, I've got my own idea for a story. I'll do that. And then that's where it comes from. It comes from that religious experience. And religion comes from a necessary community experience. So I think for me, it's that thing of like, it's why I love the bar. In a theatre. It's why I love being in a theatre, because you're really there with those people. And I think like, and nowhere was it more apparent than like when we did Boudica, where you had, you know, nearly 2,000 people, where there was a bit on the opening night of Boudica when Abe Pupula, the brilliant actor Abe Pupula, had a fight on stage with three or four soldiers. And incredible fight scene. And then my mate Clifford was in it playing Gaius Antonius, and he came on to fight Abe, and then he kills him. And just the electricity in the room when that scene was happening. Everyone was involved in that. And like shouting and screaming and booing and cheering. And then when the two daughters, Elena and Blobwyn, zipline on stage, people were losing their fucking mind. It was the same with Amelia, had the same experience. Now, I wasn't a huge fan of Amelia for lots of reasons, but undeniably, it was an incredibly powerful theatrical experience. Undeniably. It wasn't a play for me. Literally, it's not designed, made. I mean, that's really important, that theatre speaks to loads of different people. I could not, for all my kind of like dramaturgical snarking, well, that wasn't very good, all the rest of it. And I think those are, for me, things that are important. It was undeniably an electric communal experience that people needed. Yeah. And I saw people fucking weeping, saying like, I've never seen myself on stage before like that. I literally saw a person say that who was in our group. I was like, that's so powerful. That's so powerful. And then afterwards, they were all getting drunk at the bar, and it was really exciting. And that's what's great about theatre. Even when it doesn't work for you as an individual, it works for the community kind of thing. So I think that for me is what's so exciting. It's like the closest thing I've got to a church. Because I don't believe in God. I don't think traditional religion is necessary. But one thing that is necessary is the community that comes from it. So that's kind of the thing that I think is.
Yeah, what a great answer. What a great answer.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So for the next part of the podcast, I asked you to prepare a letter addressed to theatre itself. This was a very, very hard one for me to resist, because you actually elected to post me your Dear Theatre letter.
Well, I love writing. I love writing actual letters.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was thrilled because I love receiving posts. So, I was
The moon. It's a lost art. I love the theatre of sending post. It's it's such an unnecessarily theatrical thing to do. And that's why I think it's so important.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And I have it here. It's in a lovely white envelope with a red wax seal, which I was very excited about.
My dad bought me that as a joke gift without realising it's one of the best things he ever got me.
It's so great. I love it. I had to resist reading it, but I wanted to hear it firsthand when you read it out on the recording. So whenever you're ready.
Okay. Dear Theatre, fucking hell, where to begin? It's polite to ask how one is at the start of a letter, to inquire what you've been up to and how the family are, to see what you've been doing. But we all know the answer to that, don't we? Let's face it, it's been a year of consuming anxiety and stultifying boredom, of woeful depression and aggressively Pollyanna-ish optimism. It's been an emotional roller coaster, or rather, it's been like being stuck upside down for 12 months midway through a loop the loop on an emotional roller coaster, desperately waiting for someone to fix it before the blood rushes to your head and you pass out from the strain. I think we can both agree, theatre, that we just want this bastard to be over. We want this to be over so we can start doing again, start making and writing and directing and acting, start building sets and balancing budgets on spreadsheets, start focusing lights and mixing sound levels, managing PR campaigns and organising access performances, start tearing tickets and pulling pints in the theatre bar, start mending costumes and combing wigs, start making some theatre and start working together again to make something bigger than ourselves, something bigger than the four fucking walls I'm forced to stare at day in, day out as I desperately scrub through the thin and barren soil of my imagination, trying to find some inspiration, some creativity, some stories. Needless to say, I miss you, theatre. No, that's not quite right. I don't miss you, per se. I miss the people who make you. I miss all the people inside of you. I miss the writers, actors, directors, dramaturges, producers, designers, set makers, costume makers, box office staff, education leaders, marketing officers, development teams, duty managers, front of house staff, volunteers, every single motherfucker who makes a theatre a theatre. Most of all, I miss my friends. I've strived to make theatre my life and strived to make it more than a career. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like a career. I'd like to have more of a career, but let's not be greedy, eh? And be thankful for what we have got. But if all I wanted was a career, I would have become an accountant. No offense to accountants. We bloody need you and you do the Lord's work. God knows I'm too stupid to be able to do it myself. With theatre, I have a career and friends. Some deep and meaningful, some fun and flighty, some quick and casual, many a pain in the ass. But my world is built on these friends. Friends I have worked with and played with, succeeded and failed with, got drunk in the bar with after the show. What I'm trying to say is, I miss you, theatre, but I miss my friends more. And while I'm desperate to be back in the theatre again, I cannot wait to see my friends. I love you all, and I miss you all. Much love, Tristan.
That was so lovely. That was so brilliant.
Weird reading it back.
Like, is it?
Well, I was just very aware of how, like, aware I was of writing it, if that kind of makes sense. Because, you know, it's a sort of open letter to the self, isn't it? You know, so.
Yeah.
It's true, though. I think that's it. Like, I miss my friends hugely during this whole time. And I've always said I don't have colleagues. I have friends that I work with. And I really try to stand by that. Like, if we have met, if we have worked together, then you were a friend. And I mean that. There are some friends that are very profound friends who will be with you all your life or through large chunks of it. And there'll be friends who are very fun and flighty friends. They're kind of, you know, like, but they're all friends. And I think that's, for me, what I really profoundly miss most, I think.
Yeah, okay,
what have other people said about the whole, what have other responses been? Has it been similar or is it?
With the letter, do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Profoundly kind of, I miss you. That's the bit been the biggest message. But I think the wonderful thing about the letter thing is that it's also thrown up things, you know, negative things about theatre, which I think is brilliant, you know, saying, actually, you're not perfect and you're not, you know, these are all the things that you do that annoy me, you know, that kind of thing. It's like,
that's like any
great.
Good relationship. Like, you know, that's like your partner being, you sort of strive for perfection.
Yeah.
But you're always going to, they're always going to piss you off.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's interesting, like, you know, obviously what you're saying about, yeah, working with your friends, that's so right. And I think it's also just about the thing that I've really missed is just the interactions, because you can't go more than a few minutes in theatre without having an interaction with another person, like with different people, all these different people, whether that's from the marketing department or, you know, the people in the rehearsal room, or like you just happen to speak to somebody in the theatre bar, or you just, you know, it's all of those things. And actually it's all of those interactions that make up your day. And when you've not, when you don't have that, I think it's very different. It's a very different reality. It's a very different world, isn't it?
There's something Conor McPherson talked about, who's a writer I love very much. He said, so he writes and directs his own stuff, but he said he writes so that he can get into a rehearsal room and work with people. And I'm the same. Like, I love writing. I like going off in my own little world and doing my stuff, but I do it so that I can then be with people. Like, you know, I love making something bigger than myself. And I think it's that, as you said, it's those connections. It's making new connections. Every project you work on, you might meet someone who you're like, this is the this person. I'm just so. And I think actually, unlike a lot of jobs, you know, you're saying what's great about working in theatre is the very sort of transitory nature of it. It's frustrating, obviously, but like, you know, you have, I'm sure you have companies, you're like, oh, we'll all stay friends forever. And then the company dissipates and you never talk to each other again.
Yeah.
But you meet so many new people in the course of working in theatre. I haven't yet had the good fortune to work in TV and film a huge amount. I'm sure it's similar, but in theatre particularly, like, you meet so many new people, whereas if you work in an office,
yeah, it's the same people, and you know, though obviously there's differences, and that, you know, you get different people coming in and out and stuff, but it's not in on the same level.
Yeah, the amount of like people who are running through, and also different companies, like if you work in a theatre that's got multiple shows on, other companies will come and support, and you know, something that, like, you just get to meet loads of people. I think that's the great thing about theatre. It's the people.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. That was a lovely letter and I'm thrilled to have it sat here beside me in its real life form, so that I can keep it.
The only thing better than receiving a letter is writing a letter.
It's very freeing, I think. It's very, you know, you can't read it back, as you say, you know.
And you can't take it back.
Unless a very diligent stage manager takes a photo of it and sends it back to you and says, no, please read it for me on a podcast.
But it's there forever now. As long as the RSS feed is live.
Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I think there's something quite freeing about, you know, you've written something and it's gone. You now can't go and check back on it, and you can't go and reread it and torture yourself about your grammar or whatever. Like, it's just gone. It's done. And, you know, that's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it. Absolutely love it. So I'd love to move on now to the final section of the podcast, which is called The Inspiration Station. I was very excited to hear about the things that my guests are inspired by and enthusiastic about. And so I would love to know, who inspires you?
There's lots of writers and theatre makers and very specific people. It's a hard one, that. I think there's, like, you know, I could rattle off like a list of people. Like, I love, for example, Kurt Vonnegut. I love Lucy Prebble. I love Annie Baker. I love Neil Gaiman. I love Martin McDonagh. I can just rattle off a load of people I love. And there's directors I love. You know, I love Christopher Nolan and Catherine Bigelow. And, you know, just, you could sort of do that. And there's also the thing of, like, your friends and family as well. Like, they hugely inspire me. I don't think there's any one particular thing. I think there's lots of people who inspire me. But I think what's interesting is there's been a lot of, you know, the whole concept of, you know, if I think the Gina Davis Institute for the Study of Gender and Media talked about this with, like, if she can see it, she can be it campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, if all you do is represent women as housewives in films, then that's all women will aspire to be. Not literally, but, you know, sort of like that does have effect. Now, because I'm a white, straight, cisgendered, privately educated man from the suburbs, you know, like, I have been offered all these amazing, not only artistic role models in the sense of, you know, like, Hamlet is like the sort of text that we all aspire to as a kind of, like, the person that I look like, you know, that I'll do my Hamlet one day, whatever the bollocks that. But also, like, there's loads of writers before me that I can see. So I can look and go, I would like that person's career. Mm. I can go, I would like to achieve what that person achieved. And in actual fact, that's probably good and bad for me personally.
Mm.
But what I mean is, so to go back to my original point, there's loads of examples for me that show that I can do this.
Yeah.
What's very exciting now is that there's lots of other, we're beginning slowly to broaden that field and go, you know, if you're a person of colour or you're not a man, there are a growing number of role models. Still a much fewer, of course, but a growing number. But I think that's the thing that sort of inspires me, is that I look at people and go, whose career do I want? Whose career would I like to have? So there are definitely writers that I go, I would like to do. And often it's like my version of their plays. So I'm like, I want to do my version of, like, I could literally probably tell you, I won't, because I want that to be my sort of secret, but there are all my plays are sort of my version of someone else's play or album or book or show or whatever. So, like, Boudicca is an obvious one. I wanted to do a Shakespeare play, but it's also my version of Game of Thrones style big telly, although I've never seen Game of Thrones, so I can't really, like, you know, I got a lot of Game of Thrones when they were doing the reviews, a lot of the slightly less complimentary reviews were sort of saying it was sort of substandard Game of Thrones, and I was like, well, I've never seen Game of Thrones, so I can't really,
it can't be.
I was like, but I have read, when they were like, it's called Shakespeare, I was like, all right, if you think that, that's fine, because I literally went through, you know, the tetralogy. And, you know, I love Shakespeare's. Yes, I think that what inspires me is going, that person's career, I would like that career. Not, I want to take their career.
Yeah.
Like, I see that. And I think that something is very interesting, is that that sense of, if you can see it, you can be it, is expanding. And I've been very fortunate, unfairly, rightly or wrongly, I've been very fortunate in the sense of, there have been lots of people that I can very easily go, yep, there's 10 white men that I can just look at and go, that's the career I'd like, you know, sort of thing.
Next question is, what inspires you?
Again, it's a very broad thing of, like, I love watching plays and watching movies and reading books. I think that my early work, I was heavily inspired by cinema. So, like, my first ever play was a horror. My second play was a ghost story. My third play was a sci-fi. My fourth play was kind of a fantasy. They were all like my attempt to bring the ambition and scale and genre of cinema to the stage. And that's moved away a bit as it sort of goes on. So it's less literally like that, but that ambition is kind of the foundational stuff as opposed to the literal sort of stuff. I think I got a lot of ideas from reading. So, for example, this is an odd one, but I was reading a fantastic book the other day called First Catch by Tom Eagle, who's a chef and a writer and a restaurateur. And it's a book about cooking and recipes. It's sort of a recipe book without recipes, if that makes sense. It's like a collection of essays, but each essay contributes towards one meal that he's going to cook. It's the preparation of a perfect spring meal, which centers around the main dish is going to be a rabbit ragu. And there's a chapter called On Cooking Rabbit. And he talks about rabbit. He doesn't tell you how to cook a rabbit. He just talks about rabbit, like the concept of rabbit as food and how you prepare a rabbit and what that means, you know, like the physical act of breaking a rabbit apart with your hands as you prep it, you know, the physical smell and pungency of cooking a rabbit. And then he moves on to like the socioeconomic implications of rabbit, because rabbit was a very cheap and easy food for so many hundreds of years in British culture. And the reason it isn't now is because of myxomatosis. You know, they introduced, you know, there is a literal instance in which a French scientist and landowner introduced myxomatosis to his land to remove rabbits as a pest. And it spread and killed 99% of the rabbit population of Europe. And in doing so, it wasn't just like an act of ecological madness, but was also like, that's people's food.
Yeah.
Like, and this is post-war Britain. This is 1952 or three, I think it happened. You know, like we're still in rationing. You know, suddenly people have less access to food. And I suddenly was really inspired by this story about like myxomatosis and how it affected our country. So I want to do a story told from the point of view of a rabbit and a poacher who are both victims of myxomatosis. One literally because he's a rabbit and all his family and friends are dead, and one who's a poacher because his livelihood is threatened by this thing. But that came from reading a cookbook, you know.
Yeah.
So like I often find myself getting ideas from reading other people's things and going, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to do that one day. So like Boudica came from a friend of mine saying she was saying that as a female actor, she gets to do very little fun stuff. You know, male actors get to a bunch of times, but they get to ride horses and shoot guns and have sword fights. Women in theatre and Shakespeare just get to wear pretty dresses and die. And I was like, well, that's shit. We should do something about that one day. And then I think 9 years later, I wrote Boudica, inspired by that conversation. So it's very much like one tiny thing I'll latch onto, and it'll be in like a book or a conversation or in a video game, or just lots of different things. I think that's the biggest thing you can do, is just be very curious and read a lot and listen a lot. And don't be snobby about what you... You know, I think about, as a writer, I like very much called Tristan Finn Adeyeu, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, who loves video games. And he was on the Emerging Writers group with me at The Bush in 2016, 2017. And he was developing this play that was almost like a Final Fantasy game meets Toni Morrison. And I was just like, I love this smashing together of Toni Morrison, great highbrow literary figure, and Final Fantasy, of this sort of extreme, you know, highly stylized video game world. I was like, I love that. I think that's so much fun. And actually, when I think about my favorite movies, they're genre movies, you know, like some of my favorite plays are, you know, like, I think Enron is one of the best plays in the last 20 years, but it's essentially like a Greek tragedy genre piece. Do you know what I mean? It's a... Well, like Come From Away is a big genre piece, you know. It's a kind of it's a very formulaic musical, but it's brilliant. It's extraordinary, you know. So, yeah, I think it's a bit from everywhere. It's just being very open to things, and it'll come your way when you least expect it. Like with Teddy, I tell you why I got into rockabilly music. So I started listening to the Mark Kermode Show, and he's in a rockabilly band. And I just thought, oh, I love the hair. I love the attitude of rockabilly music. And I started listening, and I was like, this is great. And then I started reading about it, and then it sort of came from there. So just being open, I think, was the biggest thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And where would you say that you feel the most creatively inspired?
Probably in a library or a bookshop. Like, I find being around, it's so wanky, but like I find being surrounded by books very emotionally inspiring and very intellectually inspiring. Like, some of my happiest memories of childhood are being in the school library, this beautiful library at my school, two floors. Like mezzanines and stuff. It's really, really lovely. And I was very happy there. And I think that there's an Umberto Eco quote where he says, he's talking about like, you know, how you buy books and you never read them. He was saying, good, I want to be surrounded by more books than I'll ever be able to read. because it's the potential. Like, I can see probably 15 to 20 books in front of me that I've not read, but they carry energy and potential that makes them exciting and fills the room with that kind of, I could read that one day, inspirational kind of quality, you know? So I think a bookshop or a library I find very inspiring. I think, although other people would argue that, you know, like, so it was like, oh, this place is a rockabilly cocktail bar. I'd be like, yes, that's me all over. Like, I'm very niche in my tastes, you know? Like,
yeah. And that's like, great though. That's a great way to be.
Exactly. Like, oh, this rockabilly hairdresser's also has, you know, a cocktail bar and a comic book shop. I'd be like, yes, let me go to that. You know, very like obvious. And they sell 50s clothing. You know, so, yeah, of course it's obvious.
I am in.
Yeah, I'm in.
And then what have you discovered this week that you felt inspired by? This can be as small, as tiny, or as massive as you like.
That is, I'll be very honest with you, very little. I have to be annoyingly down on that because I think that I have really been struggling. I'm someone who's, I have no problem coming up with ideas. Like, I keep a running document on my computer of like things I'm going to write one day and they're all rattling away. Generally, now, I'll tell you what I did find a little inspiring this week. There's a couple of things. I got some great books from the library about punk rock because I want to write a show about punk rock and women in the rock scene, punk rock scene in the 1970s. And I watched a very interesting documentary about polystyrene from the band X-Ray Specs. That was very interesting and inspiring. I have found my contact with my friends inspiring this week, like because we've been allowed to see people in the gardens of this. So like on Tuesday, it was a beautiful sunny day. I went to see a friend I haven't seen for a while. And I thought we were just having a cup of tea and I turned up and he cooked arepas from scratch and made this beautiful salad and this gorgeous like little garden he's got in the back of his flat. And I was like, oh, this is lovely. All we need now is some wine. And he went, well, and then pulled out a bottle of wine, you know, so... And I came home and my girlfriend was like, you look better and happier than I've seen you in weeks. And I was like, I am. And I think actually it's like, yeah, it's the people. I'm a very extroverted person, if that isn't obvious. And I like talking a lot, if that isn't obvious. So I think that that was the thing that I found inspirational this week, was less kind of like artistic-y things and it's more actually like a bit of sunshine in my friends. I think that is the thing that's been very inspirational.
Well, I think they're really important things to be inspired by. I think that, yeah, I think... And I think that is, you know, that is what we've all kind of found this week as well.
Absolutely. The second I can crack out a mid-season jacket and like go and get pissed with a mate with a couple of beers or a nice glass of white wine, that will be delightful.
Yeah, absolutely. Tristan, what a pleasure it has been to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to meet you. It's been lovely to chat to you.
Pleasure's been mine. This has been a lovely way to spend a Friday afternoon.
Absolutely.
You know, much more fun than...
What a joy.
Just, I don't know, staring into the abyss of the my computer.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of That's Theatre, Darling. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you fancy giving the equivalent of a round of applause, you can do this by taking a moment to leave a review, subscribe, and why not just tell all of your friends about it. See you next time.